On our show coming up, we're going to hear John Mearsheimer, a leading expert on the Middle East, a historian, speaking with Katie Harper about his disappointment in Trump's response to the situation in Gaza.
We are going to bring on our next guest. This guy is someone who everyone gets so excited to hear from. He is prolific. I'm so honored that he had the time to talk to us because he's extremely in demand. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago and the author of several books, including Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics, The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams and International Realities, and is co-author of the seminal and controversial The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to the show, John Mearsheimer.
I'm glad to be here, Katie. I'm glad
thank
to
you
be
so back. Much. Yes, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so thrilled that you're here. I mean, I don't even know where to start with you, but I guess I'll start with something that I heard you say on another show, which is that you actually didn't think that Trump would be a warmonger. Can you talk about your expectation, what that was based on, and how that compares to the reality that we've been witnessing?
Well, I think in the first administration, he was not a warmonger. He did a number of things that, you know, escalated tensions in different areas. For example, he was the first president to arm the Ukrainians, at least with offensive weapons. So it, but I think by and large, in the first administration, he didn't give any indication that he was a warmonger. And when he ran in the campaign for the 2024 election, he went to great lengths to emphasize that he wanted to end all the forever wars and not start any more. And then right before he took office, as you remember, he forced Netanyahu to accept a ceasefire in Gaza. So at the very beginning, it looked like he was off to a good start. And then with regard to Ukraine, I thought there he was deeply committed to ending that war. And I thought that it may take him a bit more time than it should to shut that war down. But I thought he would eventually shut the war down and establish reasonably good relations with the Russians. But if you look at what's happened, he's failed on almost every count. We used to call Joe Biden Genocide Joe when he was in the White House. We could easily call Donald Trump Genocide Don. I mean, he's continuing the genocide for sure. With regard to Ukraine, he has failed to shut that war down. With regard to Iran, the Biden administration at least had the good sense not to let the Israelis suck us into a war against Iran. The Israelis tried twice in 2024, but Biden didn't take the bite or take the bait. But in this case, with Trump in 2025, he took the bait. And on June 22nd, he attacked Iran. So he has not done well in Iran. He has certainly not done well with regard to the genocide in Gaza. And he's not done well with regard to Ukraine. And I would add one other case to this, and that's Yemen. You remember he went to war against Yemen. He said, we'll end this quickly. I'm going to win decisively. And after roughly 30 days, he quit and conceded defeat to Yemen, to the Houthis in Yemen. But the point is that he actually started the fight against the Houthis. So if you look at his overall performance, he looks every bit as much as a warmonger as Joe Biden.
Yeah. You have stated that states are rational, not irrational, but are space rational. So I wanted to know, governments are rational, I should say. Would you classify Trump's government as rational? Would you classify Biden's as rational? And if so, how?
Well, the point is, let's just take U.S.-Israeli relations. Israel is a strategic albatross around their neck. The policies that Israel pursues in the Middle East are not in our interest. And therefore, for the Biden administration or for the Trump administration to support the policies of Israel to the extent that we do is not rational, in my opinion. And here I'm talking only about Israel being a strategic albatross around their neck. It's also a moral albatross. It's a double whammy. From a strategic point of view and from a moral point of view, our relationship with Israel is not rational. And that was true under Joe Biden, and it's true under Donald Trump. And of course, the reason that we pursue this particular policy towards Israel is because of the lobby. The Israel lobby puts enormous pressure on policymakers to support Israel unconditionally. And that, of course, is what we're doing. You know, it's very interesting to listen to you talk to the previous guest, and the conversation really revolves around what Israel is doing in Gaza. But the truth is, it's not just Israel. It's Israel and the United States. And Israel would not be able to pursue the policies that it's pursuing in Gaza with regard to Iran, with regard to Lebanon, and with regard to Syria without complete support from the United States. The reason that Israel is able to behave so aggressively is the United States supports it at every turn. We give the Israelis huge amounts of money, huge amounts of weaponry, and diplomatic support. And that frees the Israelis up to pursue these policies that I would argue are not in America's interests, as I just said, but I would also argue are not in Israel's interests. I think what's going on in the Middle East today is a disaster for Israel. And over time, I think more and more people will recognize that.
And how is that? How can you expand on what makes it a disaster for Israel?
Well, I think from a moral point of view, the genocide is a stain on Israel's reputation. It's going to be everlasting. It's going to be there forever. I mean, this is a genocide. And it's not just any genocide. It's a genocide that's basically being filmed. We can see it happening before our eyes. With regard to the Holocaust, hardly anybody saw any evidence of what was happening. The word got out of Europe that a Holocaust was taking place or a genocide against the Jews was taking place, but we couldn't see pictures of that. We didn't really know exactly what was going on at the time, and it took really a long time to sort of unpack what happened between 1941 and 1945 in Europe. But in the case of what's going on in Gaza, it's manifestly apparent what's going on. And this makes it all the more shocking, by the way, that it's been allowed to go on. The fact that people haven't revolted and forced their governments to shut this down is truly shocking. But anyway, my first point would be that this is a disaster for Israel. Second, the idea that Israel is going to have perfect security by beating up on every state in the region and breaking countries apart like Syria and Iran and Egypt and maybe Turkey is a pipe dream. That's not going to happen. And Israel in the process is going to do enormous damage to itself. It's going to end up fighting wars forever and ever. And this is not in Israel's interest, especially since those adversaries are eventually going to get the military capability to threaten Israel in serious ways. And the best example of this is the case of Iran. The Israelis are running around, and of course, Donald Trump is as well, and many hawks in the United States, saying that we have just delivered this hammer blow to Iran. We have obliterated their nuclear program. They're never going to get nuclear weapons. And if they make any steps in that direction, we'll just go back in and slam them again. I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. I think that the Iranian nuclear program is alive. The Iranians remain committed to at least enriching uranium. And I would be willing to bet that behind closed doors, they're committed to developing a bomb. They're not going to advertise that, certainly not at this point in time. But I would not be surprised for one second. In fact, I think it's likely that they will develop a bomb. So Israel hasn't solved this problem. In fact, they've made the situation worse. And the idea that they've won this great victory against Iran, or that we won this great victory against Iran, is simply not true. If anything, the key question is why the Iranians agreed to a ceasefire. If I had been playing the Iranians' hand, I would not have agreed to a ceasefire. I would have let the war go on for a couple more weeks. The Israelis were in real trouble because huge amounts of damage were being done to Israeli territory. And furthermore, the Israelis were running out of defensive missiles. And there was no shortage of ballistic missiles and drones and cruise missiles on the Iranian side. So one could make a good argument that the Iranians should have continued the war. All of this is to say that if the Israelis and the Americans start the war up again, I wouldn't bet that Israel and the United States are going to win that war. Just to take this one step further, and this is where the Americans come into play. It's quite clear that one of the reasons that Trump wanted to shut the war down after the June 22 attacks was because there was evidence that the Iranians were going to mine the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. And that really spooked Trump, as it should have. All of this is to say that if we have another conflict, there's a possibility that the Iranians will mine the Straits. And if they mine the Straits and we have a huge economic crisis, this will not be good for anyone on the planet, and certainly for the Trump administration. So the point is that even absent nuclear weapons, the Iranians have cards to play. But the Israelis act like they can just slap the Iranians around. It has no real consequences. And to the extent that it might have consequences, Iran's going to fall apart, much the way Syria did. I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. And I could go on and on with regard to this. We could talk about the centrifugal forces that are at play inside of Israel itself. This is not a happy society. This is a society that has wicked fault lines, and the animosity across those fault lines is not to be underestimated. And when you fight wars all the time like this, it invariably exacerbates those antagonisms. So I think if you look at the body politic and you look at Israel's situation in the broader region, I think the idea that they're in great shape and they just need to apply a little bit more force and get a little bit more support from the United States is not the way you want to look at this.
So why did Iran not do what you were suggesting they could have and should have done, do you think?
It's very hard to say exactly what was going on. It seems to me that the Americans were probably talking to the Russians and to the Chinese, and the Russians and the Chinese were talking to the Iranians, and they were probably putting pressure on the Iranians to shut this one down. You want to remember that the Chinese get a lot of oil out of the Gulf. And the Chinese did not want to see the Straits of Hormuz shut down. So they had an incentive to put an end to this war. I think the Russians worry about the war as well. They don't want to get dragged in. They don't have any real deep-seated interest. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Iranians were getting pressure from the Russians and the Chinese. The other thing is that almost all of the reporting on Iran tells us that there is a pretty profound split inside Iran between hardliners and softliners. And there are actually a lot of people inside of Iran who want to have good relations with the West. And in fact, I think these people would be willing to work out some sort of modus vivendi with the Israelis if the Israelis would shut down the genocide. But there is, a moderate wing inside of Iran. And I wouldn't be surprised if they made the case as well that we should shut this down now. And if need be, we can go back to fighting the war. We have the missiles to do that. So that'd be my best guess as to what happened here.
So this may be a kind of basic question, but I'm genuinely confused about how rational acting works in the real world. Is it that states act rationally, but for certain things like ideology or like extenuating circumstances or the lobby? Because you just gave a bunch of examples of, like, for the United States and Israel, that they're, what they're doing is it's not rational, correct? So how does this work?
Well, just focusing on the American case, which is what I was talking about. The first point you want to remember is that states don't always act rationally. Sebastian Rosato and I wrote this book that argues states act rationally most of the time, but there are exceptions for sure. If you were to look at the Bay of Pigs operation, which President Kennedy executed shortly after he took office, he came into office on January 1961, and then he launched the Bay of Pigs operation in April of 1961. It was a total fiasco. And it is very easy to prove that that was a non-rational or irrational decision. So the point I'm making to you, Katie, is that there are examples out there. Now, I think, as I said before, that if you look at American policy toward Israel, whether it's under Joe Biden or it's under Donald Trump, it does not make strategic sense. It's not rational. And in almost all cases, the reason states pursue non-rational strategies or irrational strategies is because of domestic politics. Domestic politics overwhelm strategic calculations. And in this case, it's the lobby. The lobby, as you know, is enormously influential in the United States. It's much less influential these days at controlling the discourse, as is evidenced by the fact that you and I are having this conversation, which tens of thousands of people will watch. So in terms of controlling the discourse, the lobby is in deep trouble. But in terms of influencing policymakers, they basically have every policymaker or almost every policymaker in their back pocket. And it doesn't matter whether you have Joe Biden in the White House, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, you name it. The lobby gets its way with policymakers. And that's domestic politics at play. And in those cases, you will find instances of irrationality. And this is certainly a case of irrationality.
So what drives Israel? I know these are like very kind of existential questions, but what motivates Israel, right? So if in America, if the United States, to be irrational, right? Because if in the United States, it's the lobby, right? So what makes Israel do things that are so not only morally reprehensible, but as you're arguing, let's not good for Israel in the long run?
Well, I'm not sure I would argue that Israel is irrational. I think that their policies are wrong-headed, but you want to remember that whether a policy is moral or not, and I abhor what the Israelis are doing. I've been arguing for a long, long time that this is a genocide, and I am super critical of the Israelis. But whether a policy is moral or not is very different from whether it's rational or not. The question you have to ask yourself is, what are the Israeli goals here? What are they trying to do? And if you go back, you know, to the early 1900s, you know, when the first, second, third aliyahs came from Europe to Israel, or what was then Palestine, and you ask yourself, what did they intend to do? What they wanted to do was create a Jewish state. And they wanted to create a Jewish state that controlled a lot of territory. Some wanted to control more territory than others, but they had grand ambitions. They were not talking about creating a tiny state, but they understood that they couldn't do this all at once. And the end result is that over time, the size of Israel has grown incrementally. They, in 1948, got a rather small state, which was then significantly expanded in 1967 when they got what are called the occupied territories, which is Gaza and the West Bank. And as we all know, those are only temporarily occupied territories. The Israelis have every intention of making the occupied territories part of Greater Israel. And now if you look at what the Israelis are doing in Lebanon, southern Lebanon, that is, and in Syria, southern Syria, that is, you can see that they're interested in Lebensraum. They want more living room. They want that Greater Israel to be even bigger than just Green Line Israel and the West Bank and Gaza Strip. They want to go beyond that. And I wouldn't be surprised if at some point they try to take territory in the Sinai and maybe territory in what's now Jordan. You do not want to underestimate their appetite. And the Israelis have never said, these are our borders. We have fixed borders, and that's the end of the game. The Israelis are interested in creating a much larger state than they now have. So that's point one. Point two is, at the very most, they want the population to be comprised of 20% Palestinians. This was the number that David Ben-Gurion used to use. He said the state had to be 80% Jewish, 20% non-Jewish.
Ben-Gurion, one of the leftist leaders of Israel. Worth noting, yeah.
Yes, for sure. Or at least a centrist.
Right, yeah. But nominally, right? Part of labor. I mean, it's just funny that this is in Israel that you still get to be called like the left and say that you want 20% maximum Palestinians.
If we could just get off on a sidetrack here. When I first started studying Israel and how it worked, I tended to think that people like Ben-Gurion were moderates, and people like Menachem Begin, who was, one might say, a mortal foe of Ben-Gurion's, they were the bad guys. Ben-Gurion and people of his ilk were basically liberal Zionists. They were the good guys. And it was people like Begin who were the bad guys. And I came to believe with the passage of time that there really wasn't much difference in what their goals were. It's just that Ben-Gurion was very good at covering up with soft language, the harsh realities of what Israel was doing and wanted to do. And Begin was more of what I call a Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of guy. He'd tell you exactly what he was doing. And the more time went on, the more I came to appreciate Begin, his basic honesty.
Right.
And this revolves around the 1967 war. The argument that people like Michael Oren and so-called liberal Zionists like to make is that in 1967, the Arab countries were about to attack Israel and destroy it. And by some miracle, the Israelis beat them to the punch. It was a preemptive strike, and they won this stunning and unexpected victory. That's the conventional wisdom. It bears little resemblance to the truth. And I remember when Menachem Begin said, let's be honest about this. It was a war of choice. We didn't have to fight this war. Begin understood full well that Israel was Godzilla going up against Bambi, or a series of Bambis. And that's why, of course, the Israelis won this great victory, a great set of victories in 1967. But Begin was a straight shooter. Right. You don't have to like what he said, but yeah, he told it like it is.
It can be helpful.
It can be very clarifying. And that was not true of people like David Ben-Gurion, I believe.
Right.
One could argue that Ben-Gurion was what Israel needed. He was more sophisticated. He understood the importance of soft power, right, and so forth and so on. But anyway, first point I want to make to you is that Israel was interested in creating lots of Lebensraum. Second point is they did not want many, if any, Palestinians inside of Greater Israel. I think 80% was the number of Jews that Ben-Gurion aimed for, but in an ideal world, it would be an all-Jewish state. Third point you want to keep in mind is that even if you create a Greater Israel that occupies a lot of territory and has a lot of military might, you want to make sure that your neighbors are especially weak. So from the beginning, the Israelis have had a deep-seated interest in breaking apart their neighbors. And you see this today in Syria. And by the way, if you go back to the famous or infamous Clean Break study of the mid-1990s, that was done by Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, and others
for the Netanyahu government.
Yes, by the neocons, right? Syria was the first target of that strategy. And of course, they're trying now to do the same thing with Iran. They want to break these states apart. They want to create dysfunctional rump states on their border. And then the fourth strand of the strategy is they want to have a great power that backs them to the hilt. And of course, today, that is the United States. So the lobby works overtime here in the United States, and the Israelis themselves work overtime to keep the United States on Israel's side. And you want to understand, getting back to my first three sets of points, that if you have that kind of ambitious agenda, you're creating Lebensraum, you're wrecking your neighbors, you're trying to push all the Palestinians out, you really need a great power to help you. And this is why the United States is so important to Israel today. And of course, Israel's supporters understand that, if not explicitly, intuitively. They understand that Israel needs the United States, not simply to survive, but it needs the United States to pursue this ambitious agenda.
So what you're saying basically is, or I will say this because I don't want people to take anything out of context, but a policy can be rational and genocidal, right? Because morality has nothing to do with rationality, with reason. So if the goal is ethnic cleansing and genocide, then being genocidal is not irrational.
That's correct.
But I mean, you're also...
Just very quickly, I think people find that very hard to accept.
Yeah.
When you say that genocidal policy can be rational, people recoil at that argument. But for analytical purposes, what is going on here is that you separate rationality from morality, right? Because rationality here is basically instrumental rationality. It's how you go about achieving your goals. It's not the goal itself. So if your goal is in effect, drive all the Palestinians out of Gaza and the West Bank, and you have to pursue a genocidal policy to do that, one can argue, as I certainly would, that that is morally bankrupt in the extreme. It violates international law, it violates basic human precepts, and so forth and so on. But you can make the argument that it is rational, given what the goal is and what the Israelis are doing. Again, that's not to justify it, just to say that it's not irrational. And by the way, I think the classic case here is Hitler.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah, please. Yeah.
I teach a lot about World War II, the 1930s, and I talked a lot about Hitler. I've written a lot about Hitler. One of the reasons that Hitler was so dangerous and so difficult to deal with was that he was, in many ways, a first-class strategic thinker. He was no Dummkopf. He was very clever, and therefore he was very dangerous. Now, am I defending Adolf Hitler and saying that he was a good guy and what he was doing made sense and so forth and so on? Of course not. But I'm just saying it's important to understand that even though he was immoral in the extreme, right? We're talking about Hitler here. The fact is that as a strategist, as someone who was making calculations about how to achieve his goals, he was very, very good. And that's what made him so difficult to deal with. If you look at what he did between 1933 and really 1941, when he invaded the Soviet Union, that was his fatal mistake. On June 22nd, 1941, he invaded the Soviet Union, and thank God that's what led to his demise. But up until June 22nd, 1941, he had one success after another. He looked like a remarkably skillful strategist. And many people have said that if he had, you know, been hit by a car on June 21st, 1941, he would be celebrated as one of the great strategists, one of the great military and diplomatic strategists of all time. I don't know if I'd go that far, but you get what I'm saying here.
Right.
So my bottom line here is, because I'm saying some state or some states person is rational, that's not to say that that person is moral.
Right. Yeah. And I think you did it. I mean, that example that you just provided with Hitler, I think lays it out very well, right? There's no question of Hitler's moral immorality, evil. But if your goal is, right, if your goal is to do certain things that are immoral, then you have certain strategies and you have that can be seen as rational. But I guess what I'm curious about is that you said that you thought that what Israel was doing was actually, some of what they were doing was not strategic, right? You said that that will exacerbate the fault line. So what is it, in your opinion, that you think that Israel is doing that is, I guess, shooting itself in the foot versus just pursuing genocide as usual?
Well, one could argue that Netanyahu is rational. Right? Again, we got to separate rationality.
Right, of course, right. Well, that's why I'm glad that I think the Hitler thing probably put everything to bed, right? If anyone had any doubts about the relationship between morality and rationality, you're invoking Hitler, I think, makes it very clear. But yes.
Yeah. But just to go to Netanyahu.
Yeah.
Netanyahu is, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, he's an extremely clever politician. You know, a lot of people tend to think that he's a fool, he's an idiot, and it's just a result of serendipity that he's managed to stay in power for as long as he has. I think that's a misreading. This is a remarkably skilled politician. He's a very smart man in lots of ways. And he has a set of goals, which I just described to you in the context of describing what I think Israel's four goals are. I think that Netanyahu shares those four goals to a T. There's just no question about that. And you can make a case that that's a smart strategy. I disagree with that. The fact is, Katie, on many policy issues, people can fundamentally disagree on what the smart strategy is for dealing with a particular problem. And let me give you a really good example that highlights this. Jeff Sachs and I are very good friends, and we have basically the same views, same exact views on Ukraine and on Palestine / Israel issues, and Iran as well. But on China, we have a fundamentally different view. We just think about that situation very differently. Now, I would not want to be in the situation where I said Jeff is irrational, because I don't think he's irrational at all. He just has a different way of thinking about how to deal with China. Now, I believe that his way is wrongheaded, and if we pursued Jeff's policies for dealing with China, we'd get ourselves into trouble. Jeff believes the reverse about me. He thinks that John has wrong-headed views about China, and we're going to get into trouble if we pursue John's views. So what I'm saying to you is, you could have a situation where two people think about how to deal with a problem in very different ways, where both of them are behaving rationally. Now, but at the same time, both sides think the other side is foolish, if that makes sense. I'm sure many viewers are having difficulty absorbing that argument. But the example of me and Jeff, I think, gets at it. But anyway, with regard to how to deal with Israel's present situation, there are lots of very smart people who think that Netanyahu is doing the right thing. that it makes good sense to create a greater Israel. And if Israel could get rid of all the Palestinians and create an all-Jewish state, that would be in Israel's interest. That's what they actually think. And you could tell a story where that makes strategic sense. I believe it doesn't make strategic sense for the reasons I laid out to you. I think ultimately Israel's going to get into one heck of a lot of trouble pursuing these policies. But what I'm saying is that different people have different views on what is the best way forward for Israel. And both of those sets of views can be rational.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you recently said something that really resonated with me about how with more and more time or over as more time goes on. Sorry, let me. I just had the quote here. As time goes on, sorry, one second. Where is that quote? Okay. The more time goes by, and I'm reluctant to say this, but I believe it is true. The Israelis look like the Nazis. Their rhetoric, their behavior, it's truly appalling. A Jewish state is behaving like the Nazis did. So can you talk about this evolution? Why you say that? What the parallels are that stand out to you? And when you started thinking this way?
Well, I think that when the war first broke out on October 7th, for about the first 2 months, I did not think it was a genocide. I thought there was no question that the Israelis were committing war crimes, but I didn't think it was a genocide. But I think by mid-December of 2023, it was becoming clear to me that it was a genocide. And of course, as you remember, I think it was December 31st of 2023. I think that's when South Africa filed its brief with the International Court of Justice. And I read that brief, and then I watched what was going on. And I was convinced that it was a genocide, and I've thought so since. But as time has gone by and I've watched this genocide evolve, the more I am reminded of what the Nazis did in World War II. This is the period 1941 to 1945. And I actually teach on the Holocaust. I give lectures on it, and I've done an enormous amount of research. At one point, I thought about writing a book on it. So I know quite a bit about it. I haven't done a lot of research in recent years, but I know the case quite well. And when you sort of look at the Israelis, the parallels are quite striking. First of all, just the rhetoric, and this was evident on October 7th and shortly after October 7th. And one could argue there was evidence of this kind of rhetoric even before October 7th. But it seems to me that if you listen to Israeli leaders talking after October 7th, they sound hardly different from the Nazis at all. The things that they say are just reprehensible, shocking. It's hard to believe that the Jews, and of course Israelis are Jews, would say such a thing, given what the Germans said back in the day. And the second thing is, you know, before the Holocaust got started, really the planning was set in place in the spring, late winter, early spring of 1941. The Germans were not sure what exactly they were going to do with the Jews. And they had this plan called the Madagascar Plan, which was to move the Jews to Africa. And you have Jews today, Israelis today, talking about moving the Palestinians to Africa. And you just sort of scratch your head and say, boy, I've heard that one before, right? And then if you look at the pictures, especially the starving children, If that doesn't remind you of Auschwitz, not only the death camps, but the concentration camps that were inside Germany, the pictures look so similar to the pictures that have survived from the Holocaust that I think you can't help but think that, you know, this is a very similar situation. And then this is not exactly on the genocide, but, you know, I was talking about Lebensraum before, and a number of people have now begun to talk about Lebensraum. I mean, you want to remember with regard to the Germans in World War II, when they invaded the Soviet Union, they were not only talking about murdering huge numbers of people, and it's very important to emphasize here that they murdered more non-Jews than they murdered Jews. I mean, this was a murderous regime like we've never seen before, in my opinion. You want to remember that the official number that the Soviets give for Soviet citizens who died in World War II is 27 million. 27 million. And I would estimate that about 8 million of those casualties are military, or those deaths. So 8 million of the 27 million, that's telling you that probably 19, 18, 17 million civilians were killed, right? And my estimate is that roughly 1 million of those Soviet citizens who were murdered were Jews, because most of the Jews were in Poland and in Romania/Hungary. But anyway, I'm just telling you, this was an incredibly murderous regime. And not only was it a murderous regime, it was interested in creating Lebensraum. I mean, they talked openly about that. And when you watch what the Israelis are doing, the wanton murder, right? They're murdering the Palestinians, and this is a genocide. And I would not argue that what's happening in Lebanon or Syria, or with regard to Iran, is a genocide. That's not a genocide, period. End of story. But nevertheless, the wanton killing of civilians in those countries by the Israelis is shocking to me. And I'm a good old-fashioned realist. It's not like I'm some pussycat, right? I understand that international politics is a rough and tumble business. But when you watch what the Israelis are doing in terms of just killing civilians and carving out Lebensraum in countries like Syria, countries like Lebanon, and so forth and so on, and just all the horrible, absolutely horrible things that are happening in Gaza, and to some lesser extent, in the West Bank, it certainly does look like the Germans.
Yeah, and lest people think that you're taking this too far, this is a Times of Israel post that was deleted, but this is from 2024, and it says, Lebensraum needed for Israel's exploding population. Israel's population is projected to grow to 11.1 million by 2030, 13.2 million by 2040, and 15.2 million by 2048. That's why hanging on to the West Bank is such a contentious issue. Lebensraum. These people need places to live in a nation short of land mass. Compare Israel to its neighbor, Jordan. And it goes on and on. Now, this was deleted, but it was also written. And deleting just shows that there's good damage control. Here's something from 2014, also from Times of Israel, when genocide is permissible. So, again, this can be, like we were talking before, sometimes these things are useful. They're clarifying. So that's why also they can be deleted. But, you know, the idea that that the lesson of the Holocaust is being perpetrated against Palestinians. I mean, the idea that never again somehow means... I mean, well, we know what it means. It means never again to a certain group of people and whatever it takes to another group of people. But what I think is so interesting about this whole question of what's rational is that it can really get to what the goal of a state or a government are, right? So sometimes things don't look rational to us, but that's only because we think that the ultimate goal is something that it may not be. So if the goal of Israel is to keep Jews safe, let's say, I don't think that Israel is a rational project for many reasons. I mean, we've talked about the Hannibal Directive, the treatment of the hostages, the way that they are, I would say Israel is creating, I mean, what can create more anti-Semitism than claiming that you are acting in the name of Jews as you live stream a genocide? But if, so it's not rational if that's the goal, but then if it is more of a, if it is a much more aggressive, ambitious project, then it is more rational, right? So you can almost like you can almost work backwards and figure out what the real goals of a government are by looking at what they're doing. That can, yeah, you can see through the lie. You get to see the difference between what the claims are and what the realities are.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're basically saying what I was saying about, you know, what is rational and what is not rational. You can have an absolutely horrible goal and be very rational in your pursuit of that goal.
Right.
And that doesn't mean you're behaving morally. It just means that you're behaving strategically.
Right.
And again, as I said before, Adolf Hitler was a remarkably smart strategist. He made mistakes, and thankfully he made the ultimate mistake of invading the Soviet Union, but he was not a fool. And that's what made him so dangerous. But, you know, I want to make another point based on what you were saying when you were reading from that, I think it was the article about Lebensraum, where Israel has this exploding population.
Right.
First of all, Israel, in my opinion, probably has about this is inside Greater Israel today. You have probably about 7.3 million Palestinians and about 7.3 million Jews. And if they expel all the Palestinians like they want to, you'd probably have 7.3 million Jews. But the other question you have to ask yourself is, what's going to happen to all those Israeli Jews over time? How many are going to stay there? How many have already left? How many will leave when the shooting stops? I mean, what is the future of Israel? And I would argue it's not a very bright future. I talked about the fault lines inside the society before and what that means for the future. I think all of this war, it really spooks people. And when you see that you have neighbors that have missiles that can hit you and you get into, you know, fights like the fight that the Israelis just got into with the Iranians, you want to ask yourself, what are the consequences of that for the population? Will people leave? Are people going to go to Israel? I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. And I wouldn't be surprised if a good number of people leave because they just don't feel safe there. And by the way, we were talking about the possibility of Iran getting nuclear weapons. What if Iran gets nuclear weapons and at the same time, Israel and Iran continue to have poisonous relations between the two countries? Would you want to live in Israel? I'm not sure about that. You know, it's the size of a postage stamp. And you have this country, Iran, and we're hypothesizing that it might have a couple nuclear weapons. This is not a good situation. I think that if you look at this country, it does not have a bright future. Now, I think that Benjamin Netanyahu would disagree with that. And he would tell people that if you follow my policies and the Americans support us hook, line, and sinker, we're going to create a greater Israel and live happily ever after. But right. I don't think so.
So it's kind of his mistake, his strategic mistake, you think is relying on the goodwill or the unwavering support of the West? Because part of me thinks maybe it is rational because no one is standing up to this starvation, to this like genocidal behavior that invokes so many comparisons to the Holocaust. And I have to say that I'm working on this documentary about Holocaust survivors speaking out against the genocide. And I've interviewed people who are survivors, the children of survivors, but also people who are just involved in the Middle East. And I interviewed Daniel Levy the other day, who used to be an Israeli negotiator. He's English, but he spent a lot of time in Israel. And he said that, you know, he used to always avoid comparisons between the Nazis and Israelis, and that it's very forbidden, verboten, right? Israel, you're not allowed to do that. Only Israel can weaponize the Holocaust. No one else can use it. So they get to call other people Nazis. They get to call Hamas Nazis, but you can't make any parallels. But what Daniel Levy said was that it's almost like Israel is daring people to compare them to the Nazis with their actions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the key piece here, by the way, I mean, I've read a number of pieces by Daniel, and I know him quite well, and have great respect for him. But the key piece is the key pieces are the writings of Omer Bartov, who is an Israeli by birth, served in the IDF, and has been a historian of the Holocaust at Brown University for a long time. I actually have taught his books over time in my classes, and he is highly regarded. And he has said that he believes that what the Israelis are doing is a Holocaust or is a genocide. And that really, I think, has had a big impact. And of course, you know, all sorts of individuals and organizations with real standing, like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, various people in the United Nations have said that this is a Holocaust or a genocide. And so I think that that label is now beginning to stick in ways that leaves many Israelis and certainly the Israeli government very uncomfortable. And they'll go to great lengths to cut against that. But the more this goes on, the more difficult that becomes. And you want to remember here, we just want to think about this just when we're assessing the strategy. What's the ending here? You know, how does this end? I'm hoping every day, I hope that Trump moves in and says enough is enough, and the Israelis are forced to accept a ceasefire and supply trucks flow into Gaza. Let's assume that that happens. That would be wonderful in a certain sense, but at the same time, it hardly goes any ways towards solving the basic problem. These people have no homes. Gaza's been made unlivable. They really have no place to go unless the Madagascar option is realized. And I don't think that's going to happen either. But what's the end result here? And, you know, the Israelis don't like the idea of having 7.3 million Palestinians in their midst. Okay, but you can't get rid of them. Therefore, you have 7.3 million Palestinians inside your borders, and those people are living in the most horrible of conditions. What does this mean? The world is going to mobilize against you. Maybe the U.S. government will protect you, and it will limit the leverage of the so-called international community. But nevertheless, the consequences for your country are going to be horrific, right? You're going to be the moral stain on your reputation is going to be huge. And what does that mean for people who live inside Israel? And furthermore, just to take this a step further, because we want to think about where this train is headed, what about the lobby? You know, the lobby is already overexposed from its own point of view. It's out in the open. It's playing smash mouth politics. It's acting in ways that are fundamentally at odds with basic American values like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Is the lobby going to be forced to continue acting this way for year after year? This will be disastrous for the United States. This is a terrible situation inside the United States. The situation with the lobby is terribly unhealthy for liberal America. And I don't mean liberal in the sense of a liberal Democratic Party. I mean liberal in the Lockean sense of the term, liberal in the sense that we're all part of a liberal society. Having the lobby, you know, act the way it's been acting in recent years for the foreseeable future would be disastrous. So if you sort of think about where we are and how we get out of this, I don't see any solution at all. And I think pursuing Netanyahu's policies just make the situation worse. But again, if you go to the, I think vast majority is probably too strong a word, but the clear majority of Israel's supporters in the United States, and tell them that we're in a terrible situation, they would agree. And if you say, how do we get out of it? They would say, more force, just, you know, pound the Palestinians, pound Israel's neighbors. That's the solution. And I've long ago come to the conclusion that there are real limits to what you can do in any situation like this with military force. But Israel and its supporters, they reject that line of argument. They think that you can solve political problems with the big stick, with the Iron Wall, with military force. But right. I don't think so.
Yeah, the Iron Wall, of course, which is, of course, reminds one of Jabotinsky, who's another Texas Chainsaw Massacre type of leader, who, again, in a very refreshing, clarifying way, said the quiet part out loud. You know, Israel is a colonial project. I mean, he talked about how natives always resist colonizers, and he was referring to the Palestinians and the Israelis. You know, he wasn't obviously being critical. He was embracing it. He and other revisionist Zionists were, in some ways, it's much easier to deal with because you know what you are dealing with. But so, I mean, if we look at history, though, as an example, like, will Israel be just fine as long as it doesn't try to invade Western Europe or Eastern Europe?
Well, it's not going to be just fine. It's
not stopped, I should say.
It's at war with a handful of its neighbors. It's a highly aggressive state, prone to violence. And there's no evidence that that's going to change. It has this huge looming problem with Iran. It has powerful centrifugal forces at play inside the body politic. And I believe the situation with the lobby here in the United States is not sustainable over the long term. I think now that what the lobby does is out in the open, and now that the lobby's playing smash mouth politics, that this can't go on forever. And so I think Israel is in real trouble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I hope it's to me, it's just like whether it will be stopped. When will it be stopped? What will it take for it to be stopped? Some kind of domestic pressure on the West that makes the West finally pull the plug on it?
I don't know. Your question is a great question.
And requires clarification.
You and I are on the same wavelength, so I think about that question all the time. Lots of people ask me that question. And what I really wish is I wish that I had a happy story to tell you. I wish I could say, Katie, listen, I think these two things are going to happen over the course of the next year, and then this situation is going to come to an end. I mean, I, to be very honest, find it hard to believe that the genocide in Gaza continues. I just can't believe it, especially now that we have all these pictures of starving children. You just sort of shake your head and say, how can this be? How can people not shut this one down?
Right.
I mean, it's not like Israel is that powerful vis-a-vis the West and especially the United States. We have tremendous leverage here. You want to remember, as we talked about before, President Trump, the day before he became President Trump, sent Steve Witkoff to the Middle East, this is January 19th, to effect a ceasefire, right? Because Trump didn't want what was going on in Gaza to be going on January 20th. So they shut it down. And it looked like there was a pretty good ceasefire agreement that might form the basis of a lasting agreement or an agreement that would last for maybe a couple of years. But that all went up in smoke quite quickly, and here we are.